Richard Martin's Wake Up Call podcast, presented every Monday and Friday, providing you with the truth and the facts. You decide.
Good day to you all, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to the show. This is Richard Martin, and you are, of course, listening to the Wake Up Call coming to you from Penang on Monday, October the 26th, 2015. Now, today I'm going to make things a little difficult for some of you, because I'm going to have a hard-headed chat with you about lifestyles and their consequences. Some of you will find this a bit disquieting. Others will flat out disagree. But you all need to come to terms with that which happens when what goes around does, in fact, inevitably come around. So settle in for a listen and try not to be too judgmental until I'm finished. Two recent surveys, along with numerous other studies and data, reveal most American households to be living on the brink of catastrophe, but continuing to act in a reckless and delusional manner. There have certainly been economic factors beyond the control of average Americans that have resulted in median real household incomes remaining stagnant for the last 36 years. The unholy alliance of mega corporations, Wall Street, and bought-off corrupt politicians have gutted the nation of millions of good-paying jobs under the guise of globalization, while making use of debt, derivatives, and financial schemes to enrich themselves. The malfeasance of the sociopathic privileged class does not exempt the personal responsibility of citizens for living within their means. A lack of discipline, the inability to delay gratification, the failure to understand basic mathematical concepts, materialistic envy, absence of critical thinking skills, and a delusional view of the world are the major elements which have left the majority of Americans broke and in debt. It's very significant to see how little the average American household has in savings. Roughly 62% of Americans have less than $1,000 in savings, and 21% don't even have a savings account, according to a new survey of more than 5,000 adults conducted this month by Google Consumer Survey for personal finance website GoBankingRates.com. This dreadful data is reinforced by a similar survey of 1,000 adults carried out earlier this year by personal finance site Bankrate.com, which also found that 62% of Americans have no emergency savings for a medical crisis, car repair, or unanticipated household expenditure. The fact is that these are not highly unlikely scenarios. They happen every day as part of our routine existence. Everyone gets sick. Every car eventually needs new tires or an engine repair. Every home will need a new hot water heater or roof at some point. It's foolish and short-sighted not to expect unexpected expenditures. Living in the moment and fulfilling your immediate desires may feel good today, but it leaves you susceptible to disaster tomorrow. Gradually building a rainy day fund over time is what adults are supposed to do. Only immature children operate with no safety net. Everyone has an excuse for why they end up living on the edge, but the data exposes Americans in general to be an infantile nation of spendthrifts, incapable of distinguishing between wants and needs. It might be understandable for young adults who are burdened by student loan debt and entry-level jobs to have little or no savings. But the data for older Americans is most disturbing. It seems that 51% of all Generation X adults between the ages of 35 and 54 in the prime earning years of their lives have zero savings, the highest among all age cohorts, with over 20% of them not even having a savings account. This is incomprehensible and reveals an almost juvenile approach to life. Approximately 70% of all 35 to 54-year-old households have $1,000 or less in savings. These are people who should have been working for the last 10 to 30 years. Not to have put aside more than $1,000 is beyond irresponsible, and the justification of earning no interest on savings is disingenuous, as they could have earned 5% until 2008. This shocking state of affairs can't only be laid at the feet of the evil bankers and rich corporate titans. Every person has to accept personal responsibility for his or her own life. There is one surefire way to accumulate savings, and that is to spend less than you earn. It sounds simple, but the vast majority of Americans have chosen to live way beyond their means by allowing themselves to be lured into debt by the Wall Street debt peddlers and their Madison Avenue media maggots selling dreams to willfully ignorant, delusional consumers. Consumer-dependent corporations hawking autos, electronics, glittery baubles, fashionable attire, toxic processed sludge disguised as food, and other slave-produced Chinese crap require a vast, unlimited supply of easy money debt to keep profits rolling in. And the Federal Reserve has been willing and able to accommodate them. Those who control the levers of this perverted economic system make use of Fed easy money, propaganda advertising messages, and the susceptibility of an oblivious populace suffering from delusions of grandeur to create generations of debt-enslaved hamsters running on the wheel of life. But we were not forced into this enslavement. Millions have chosen to live lives of quiet desperation in order to keep up with the Joneses. They'll portray themselves as successful and wealthy rather than make the necessary sacrifices required to achieve success and wealth. Everyone has the ability to live beneath their means. Millions have made the choice to do so. 10 to 20% of people do have $10,000 or more in savings, including young people. Many are average middle-class Americans, not the despised 1%. It is certainly not easy to accumulate savings in an economy stacked against the working middle class, but it is possible. It requires self-discipline, deferring gratification, patience, budgetary skills, staying employed, and not coveting your neighbor's possessions. The lack of short-term savings is not an isolated data point. It's representative of a nation of narcissistic, live-for-today ne'er-do-wells who rarely concern themselves with the future or the consequences of their actions. They haven't been putting all their spare cash into their retirement plans either. When you realize that the typical household between the ages of 35 and 54 has less than $10,000 saved for their retirement, the mass delusion becomes clear. Here's the million-dollar question you have to ask yourselves. Here. How could boomers, who have worked for 30 to 40 years and experienced the greatest bull market in history from 1982 to 2001, how could they have only $12,000 of retirement savings as they approach retirement? These are median figures, so half the households have even fewer retirement savings. It requires decades of living above your means to have accumulated so little in savings. The apologists for the non-saving masses often argue that Americans were using their homes as a store of wealth to be used in retirement. This is just another false storyline, as the savings-poor public used their homes like an ATM machine from 2001 through 2008, extracting hundreds of billions to spend on granite countertops, exotic Caribbean vacations, home theatres, BMWs, Olympic-sized pools, bling and new boobs for mummy. Equity in homes plunged from 60% to below 40% in the space of a few years, and it's only recovered to 55% after the Fed-induced false housing recovery. There are still millions of homeowners underwater, with the next leg down guaranteed to add millions more. The millions of American households living on the edge and headed for a poverty-stricken old age have a million excuses for why they never saved a dime. These are the same people who will demand that the government save them from their own folly and irrational life choices. They'll demand that the rich, which is anyone who worked hard, saved, and planned for their future, be taxed more, so that these people don't have to live with the consequences of their reckless disregard for common sense and self-discipline. These people should have read some Shakespeare in high school, and maybe they wouldn't be in this predicament. The fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves. William Shakespeare from Julius Caesar. We are all responsible for our own lives and our own decisions. It isn't complicated regarding how to save money, but it is hard. It requires simple math skills like addition, subtraction, multiplication, and division, concepts not thought too important in your government-controlled educational system. It requires self-control, acting like an adult, and distinguishing between what you want versus what you need. It's okay to splurge once in a while, but since around 1980, multiple generations have been binge spending in an orgy of debt debauchery, unmatched in human history. Since 1980, the US population has gone up by a factor of 1.42. GDP has expanded by a factor of 6.3. And consumer debt has exploded by a factor of 10. The amount of consumer debt per person in 1980 was $9,300. Today, the total is an astounding $65,200 per person, a 700% increase in 35 years. Americans owe $21 trillion of mortgage, credit card, student loan, and other debt to the felonious Wall Street bankers. Your nation has gone insane. You know what Friedrich Nietzsche said? Well, it's apt. He said, quote unquote, "In individuals, insanity is rare, but in groups, parties, nations, and epochs, it is the rule." With a median household income of about $56,000 and median net wages per worker of $29,000, it's fairly easy to grasp the monthly inflow of a middle-income household. In median world, taxes will take about a 16% chunk out of those figures. So the median household ends up with about $4,000 of take-home pay per month. If they own a median-priced home of $189,000, their monthly mortgage payment would likely be about $850. Add another $200 to $300 per month for property taxes, and you are on the hook for $1,100 per month. A median rent figure would be in the same ballpark, unless you live in San Francisco, New York City, or a few other overpriced markets. This is where many people go off course, allowing themselves to be lured into more house than they can really afford, with low down payments guaranteed by the government, driving the monthly housing burden north of $1,500. McMansion envy has destroyed more lives in the last 10 years than any other delusion. Food, clothing, utilities, and home upkeep expenses could total $1,500 a month for a family with kids. If one or both parents are stuck with student loan debt, a monthly payment of $200 to $400 would be normal. There isn't much spare change left to fund their remaining needs, wants, and desires. But their neighbours and co-workers are all driving new cars. They can't be seen driving a used 10-year-old clunker. People will think they're poor. Shallow appearances are all that matter to a vast swath of America. According to Edmunds.com, the average monthly payment on a new vehicle is $479. We can't have one spouse driving a new car while the other slums it on public transportation. So two newer cars will add another $900 or so of expenses to the monthly budget. Wall Street and the automakers are only too glad to offer those with good credit a 7-year 0% loan, guaranteeing a permanent status of being underwater on your loan until you must have that new model after 4 years, rolling the underwater loan into the next purchase. The permanent leasers convince themselves they are making a good deal as they sign their lives away every 3 years without understanding the financial implications of the leases. And then there are the 20% subprime auto buyers who pretend to pay until the repo man shows up in the middle of the night. This delusion of debt is how annual auto sales have soared from 10 million in 2009 to almost 18 million today. Driving in America, it's mind-boggling to see the number of newer $30,000 to $50,000 vehicles cruising the highways and byways of the country. Even in the poverty-stricken neighborhoods of West Philly, brand new BMWs, Cadillacs, and other $25,000 or more vehicles are parked in front of dilapidated hovels and low-income housing complexes. Virtually none of these vehicles are owned outright. Americans are essentially renting their luxury wheels so they can appear successful. The way to become financially successful on a modest income is to buy used cars and drive them for 10 or more years. The years of no car payment can be directed into savings. Very few people chose this path. That's why auto loan debt has now exceeded $1 trillion, up 40% since 2010. Wall Street wants you in perpetual debt, and millions have bought it hook, line, and sinker. But at least they appear prosperous to their neighbours, while they are really in debt up to their eyeballs. The choice to indulge in driving overpriced ornamental transportation basically leaves the average household with little or no discretionary income at the end of the month. But that doesn't stop super spendthrift nation from becoming addicted to their mobile phones and binge-watching reality TV. The average American, who'd never heard of a mobile phone in 1990, now can't go 20 seconds without checking their phone. And they're paying through the nose for the privilege of staying terminally connected. Really? We have smartphones for dumb people, even welfare recipients without jobs, living in low-income housing and dependent on food stamps, somehow find the funds to have a smartphone in their hand 24/7. Maybe directing those funds towards books might give them a better chance of exiting poverty. In one survey, 46% of Americans with mobile phones said their monthly bill was $100 or more, and 13% said their monthly bill topped $200 per month. The average individual's cell phone bill was $73 a month last year, a 33% increase since 2009, according to J.D. Power and Associates. When they're not texting, tweeting, or Facebooking on their iGadgets, they're watching basic cable boob TV at average price of $100 a month, up 39% since 2010. But our connoisseurs of crapola need the NFL package, HBO, Showtime, Netflix, and on-demand porn. Tricked out smartphones and cable packages are not necessities. They are wants. Wasting $200 to $300 a month on narcissistic compulsions is a choice, ladies and gentlemen. Possibly the largest squandering of resources occurs on a daily basis as Americans spend money they don't have on $5 lattes, toxic fast food stuff, craft beers, and whatever else strikes their fancy. According to the most recent Bureau of Labor Statistics consumer expenditure surveys, the typical household spends $2,625 each year, or around $219 per month, on food away from home. Those in higher income brackets spend the most on restaurants at around $370 per month. Millennials, who have the least amount of discretionary funds, view dining out as a social event and choose fun and frivolity over finances. The concept of brown bagging your lunch for $1 rather than spending $10 at Panera's, or brewing a pot of coffee for 25 cents rather than paying $5 at Starbucks, is inconceivable for the live-for-today credit card cowboys and cowgirls. Dining out is the ultimate personal choice and a huge factor in the non-existent savings of American households. Over the last two decades, Americans have abandoned the frugality of buying food at the grocery store on sale, using coupons, in favor of eating out at a hefty premium on a daily basis. The result has been a $10 billion gap in spending between groceries and dining out being obliterated by an army of five for today. For tomorrow, we can make the minimum payment on our credit card, juveniles. Not only has this penchant for satiating their hunger contributed greatly to their lack of savings, but it's been financed on their credit cards. that $25 Applebee's dinner, financed at 18% interest over the next 10 years, ends up costing $54. Multiply this madness hundreds of times a year over decades, and now perhaps you can understand why boomers have less than $1,000 in savings accounts and $12,000 or less in retirement savings. It's just math. The expenditures I've just detailed don't include healthcare, entertainment, vacations, government extractions, that's tolls, fees, fines and taxes, and other assorted miscellaneous wastes of money. It's pretty clear that the monthly outflow exceeds the monthly inflow for the majority of Americans. That's why the average household has credit card debt of $7,500, and those carrying a balance pay an average interest rate of 14% on their $16,000 ball and chain. This is on top of an average mortgage obligation of $155,000 and average student loan commitment of $32,000. The Wall Street hucksters are only too happy to help you finance a lifestyle well above your true means. They borrow from the Fed at 0.25% and charge you 10 to 20% for the use of credit created out of thin air. They always win. The willfully ignorant are thrilled that they can now pay their IRS bill, property taxes, utilities, and just about every daily expense with a credit card. They fail to acknowledge the insanity of their chosen life path. Human beings are rational, sentient, living, corporeal substances. What separates us from animals is our ability to think and act in a rational manner, rather than just on instincts and urges. Based on what has occurred in your country over the last 35 years, I'm starting to question the rational part. It's almost as if a mental illness has befallen the majority of Americans. The deep state and their minions on Wall Street and the corporate media certainly attempt to mold and manipulate the minds of the masses. But at the end of the day, people are free to disregard those messages and live meaningful lives on their own terms. Even though living above your means has become normal, it's only normal in relation to our profoundly abnormal society. Telling people the truth today is meaningless. They don't want their illusions destroyed. But destroyed they will be when this teetering edifice of debt comes crashing down on their heads. Let me finish with a quote from Aldous Huxley out of Brave New World Revisited. Quote, "The real hopeless victims of mental illness are to be found among those who appear to be most normal. Many of them are normal because they are so well adjusted to our mode of existence, because their human voice has been silenced so early in their lives, that they do not even struggle or suffer or develop symptoms as the neurotic does. They are normal, not in what may be called the absolute sense of the word. They are normal only in relation to a profoundly abnormal society. Their perfect adjustment to that abnormal society is a measure of their mental sickness. These millions of abnormally normal people, living without fuss in a society to which, if they were fully human beings, they ought not to be adjusted." End of quote. Or, and just one other one, a quickie from Friedrich Nietzsche, quote unquote, Sometimes people don't want to hear the truth because they don't want their illusions destroyed.
Share the truth. Invite others to listen to Richard Martin's Wake Up Call. Richard Martin produces his shows single-handedly, based on his extensive reading and research. Every week, Richard gives you the facts with no spin, for you to make informed decisions on world events that will affect your life. Now, let's get back to today's show.
All right, I'd like to read you from an interview with Rick Ackerman. That's one of the country's most successful investors and analysts. I don't usually do this, but since I agree with everything he says, I thought it worthwhile to bring it to your attention. I actually put this out over the email subscribers list as a weekend watching, but it's so important, I'm going to give you the highlights here. Ackerman says that the mother of all market meltdowns is a sure thing. It's just a question of when. When it starts, it will simply implode at a stunning pace. Ackerman explains, and I quote, "We're in a situation now where any day something can happen. I think that the black swan will be something like the stock market starting down for no apparent reason. That in itself would trigger the implosion, and I think the only thing that is propping up the markets now is the mentality of how bad things can be seen to be if the stock market is trading within shooting distance of all-time highs. I think the stock market is the main buttress of this enormous hoax that's been going on with easing, that's quantitative easing or monetary printing." End of quote. Ackerman says that when the game finally crescendos, it will be stunning and quick. Ackerman contends, and I quote, "It will be literally overnight. There are investors who say, 'I'm smart and nimble, and I'll be out of this at the first sign of trouble.' I think the first sign of trouble will be a little bit too late. You'll wake up one morning and something will have happened in the Asian markets that caused the US markets to open way below their circuit breakers or threaten to break the dam. It could all happen overnight, and I think it will. It's the nature of the markets." End of quote. Ackerman says everything will shut down or be wiped out when the next crash explodes. Things like banks, brokerages, and pensions can and will all go poof in a cloud of smoke. Ackerman goes on to say, and I quote, "I don't think anything will be left standing in the smouldering ruins. It's very hard to imagine, but it's really going to be a complete disaster, commensurate with the scope and scale of the lies we've been telling ourselves for so long. There are people who say, 'You chicken little doomsday skies falling guys,' almost seem to want the system to implode. I think the only way we get back to honest business is for a collapse to wipe away all the lies." End of quote. One of the biggest lies comes from the Fed when it repeatedly keeps threatening to raise interest rates. Ackerman's been calling BS on a Fed rate hike for years and still contends, quote, "I haven't merely said the Fed wouldn't raise rates. I've been shouting it from the rooftops." The answer to the question, when will the Fed raise rates, is never, and I am going to stick by that. That forecast has held up for 9 years, so it's looking pretty good. End of quote. One of the very big problems with a rise rate is not just the increased interest payments on the federal debt, but also with derivatives in the hundreds of trillions of dollars which could destabilize the financial system. Ackerman explains, quote, "It's a global thing. We'd be ratcheting up the interest payments on a quadrillion dollar derivatives market, and, as you can imagine, that would unsettle a lot of arrangements. I'm going to stick with lower interest rates with the whole world slipping into recession." End of quote. Ackerman recently wrote about the constant threats of a Fed rate hike and the most recent head fake in September 2015. Ackerman said, quote, "This latest little piece of kabuki can only add to the credibility of our own forecast, which is that the Fed will never raise rates." Okay, we were being facetious when we first made that prediction a couple of years ago. Never is indeed a long time. But what kind of odds would you take to wager that there will be no rate hike for at least the next 10 years? You could probably get 30-1 from economists, editorialists, pundits, and other useful idiots who never seem to tire of telling us that a rate hike is imminent. Realize that you would be within a year of collecting on that bet if you'd made it back in 2006, when the last rate hike was announced. End of quote. Well, I'm going to devote a fair amount of time giving you a detailed analysis of one of the country's biggest and most prestigious companies and its awful fortunes, or maybe I should call them misfortunes, dead ahead. If you ever come back to this particular archive of my show in years to come, you will wonder why people never saw this coming. You will marvel at the ignorance and stupidity of the Wall Street analysts who talked up the fortunes of a falling giant right up to the end. Well, it's not years ahead right now. It's today. And I'm going to blow this whole charade open for you so you can get advance notice on a fate so grim and unthinkable you will not want to think about it again for a long time. The IBM unbeat goes on. Its sales plunged again for the 14th straight quarter, while its net income was down by 14% from last year. Even management's dodgy ex-items earnings guidance for 2015 was lowered by 6%, with only one quarter to go. And this is not a passing swoon. IBM's third quarter revenues were actually back to 2002 levels. It is hard to find a worse trend in revenue since Bethlehem Steel disappeared a few decades ago. But the ugly sales aren't the half of it. The real story is that IBM's relentless decline is proof positive that financial engineering is a destructive toxin that is leeching the lifeblood of the nation's business enterprises. Indeed, IBM is a big blue canary. The abysmal facts of its self-destruction over the last decades should be a wake-up call to the bubble-blind Keynesians who run the Fed. But these academic theoreticians and power-obsessed apparatchiks haven't noticed, even as they continue to jabber about the sheer noise emitted by the BLS. When it comes to what is actually important, like the health and stability of the financial system, they have no clue about the manner in which their so-called extraordinary policies of zero interest rate policy and quantitative easing have actually booby-trapped the financial system with explosive time bombs. Thus, IBM's share price plunge of 35% since its peak valuation of $215 2 years ago is a hint of things to come, a warning that even the casino gamblers will dump and run when the destructive and unsustainable effects of financial engineering become sufficiently evident. IBM has lost $100 billion of market cap since its 2013 peak. But it wasn't due to a fundamental deterioration in its business model or a quantum change in the competitive environment in which it operates. Instead, even the fast money gamblers in the hedge fund sector finally caught up with the long-term damage to its earnings potential and competitive viability that resulted from its massive, sustained foray into gross financial engineering. So doing, they have provided a powerful demonstration that today's towering stock market valuations did not arise out of a return to prosperity on Main Street. Instead, like in the case of IBM's share price doubling between 2011 and 2013, they have been vastly inflated by central bank and tax policy-induced diversion of massive amounts of corporate cash to the stock market in order to goose share prices and the value of executive stock options. Needless to say, IBM's corporate suite was no outlier. Its repudiation, as dramatized, lies in the future for most of corporate America. It cannot be gainsaid that financial engineering has left great enterprises like IBM and Hewlett-Packard financially crippled and lacking the resources to compete effectively, innovate, and grow. Despite a steady stream of bolt-on acquisitions, for example, IBM's revenues have dropped by 22% from a peak of $107 billion in 2011 to $83 billion during the LTM period just reported. At the same time, the $5 trillion of corporate cash, which was flushed into stock buybacks, M&A deals, and leveraged buyouts since 2008 and the crisis, has left the stock market stranded high and dry and vulnerable to a thundering collapse. That's because this massive flow of financial engineering dollars functioned as a big, fat bid for company shares that did not reflect real demand from investors and savers. The sell-side shills keep insisting that it's all about their forward earnings hockey sticks, but that just plain malarkey. You can't hide a $5 trillion elephant in the room. Indeed, the 24/7 financial engineering practiced by the corporate suite in corporate America essentially amounts to self-dealing by public companies and the Wall Street fast money which drafts on their maneuvers and announcements. This insidious process temporarily inflates share prices, but ultimately leaves them vulnerable to collapse when the self-dealing and front-running stops. In fact, after an extended period of time, the worst of both worlds materializes. Companies become so financially weakened that they are forced to curtail the flow of cash into the stock market, causing their artificially elevated share prices to deflate. At the same time, their quarterly performance begins to deteriorate and disappoint due to accumulated balance sheet leverage and prolonged underinvestment in capital assets, R&D, and operational improvements, thereby inducing even further stock price declines. IBM is now the poster boy. During the last decade, it conducted a non-stop exercise in massive financial engineering. It deployed every trick in the book, including massive stock buybacks, generous dividends, chronic M&A deals, siphoning cash from its depreciation and amortization accounts, starving research and development, fiddling its tax rate lower, and taking on a huge increase in its balance sheet leverage. And that is to say nothing of the temporary earnings inflation that resulted from the Fed's campaign to squash the dollar after the Lehman crisis. All of this was conducted on a grand scale due to IBM's massive size and global presence. During the nearly 11 years since 2005, that's 43 quarters through to September 2015 year to date, Its cumulative sales topped $1 trillion, and its net income amounted to $140 billion. But net income is also where the trouble starts. During the same period, IBM repurchased 40% of its stock on a net basis and upwards of 50% on a gross basis. That is, before giving effect to the continuous cornucopia of new stock options its board showered on management. It also paid a rich and rising dividend during the last 43 quarters. In all, cumulative buybacks total $133 billion and dividends another $42 billion. IBM distributed $170 billion, or 125% of its cumulative net income, to shareholders. That's obviously a recipe for eventual corporate liquidation and extinction, and one that might have been appropriate to an Eastman Kodak tethered to a specific narrow film technology that was made obsolete by the digital age. But IBM claims to be a leader of that very digital technology revolution and conducts a massive software and consulting business based in the latest technology developments. The motivation at Armonk for flushing $175 billion it didn't have into the stock market was not financial euthanasia. It was not to help IBM, as it were, go quietly into the night. It was not an assisted corporate suicide. It was done purely and simply to goose IBM's short-term stock price and fatten executive option winnings. And this destructive policy was happily adopted by its executives and board because the Fed had made debt dirt cheap and because years of massive financial repression, Wall Street coddling, and the Greenspan Bernanke Yellen put had created a class of hedge fund speculators who draft on corporate financial engineering, and finally, because the sharp bias of the IRS code in favor of tax-deductible debt and lightly taxed capital gains had provided a massive subsidy to debt-financed stock buybacks and executive stock options. There's only one way to look at this, really, if you want the unvarnished truth and strip away all the flim-flam. The Fed and the IRS have teamed up to put the mainstream economy at risk, while we all have to endure the way in which their policies shower management, boards, insiders, and the Wall Street casino with massive unearned windfall gains. Self-evidently, Sam Palmisano, who was CEO from 2001 to 2012, was the original architect of IBM's financial engineering policy, and is thereby among those fully accountable for its ruination. But like so many other CEOs in the era of bubble finance, he walked off into the night with $100 million for his efforts. Needless to say, Armonk's strip mining policy appeared to work for a while. Its share price rose from $60 at the 2002 bottom to a peak of $215 in March 2013, including IBM's generous 3% dividend. Total returns to shareholders averaged 16% per year over the period. And the sell-side pitchmen of Wall Street said it was all warranted. After all, IBM's earnings rose from $5 to $16 a share over the decade, or at a 12% annual rate. IBM was proclaimed a global growth machine that would never stop rising, and a one-decision stock that would keep on giving. Except none of that was true. What happened? was that IBM lawyers and accountants managed to shuffle its tax domiciles sufficiently to lower its tax rate from 34.6% in 2005 to 19.6% in its most recent LTM period. Likewise, its share count dropped from 1.6 billion to 970 million during the period, owing to its massive buyback program. Moreover, IBM also drastically reduced its R&D spending during the period, thereby further inflating reporting earnings per share. In fact, inflation-adjusted dollars R&D spending dropped by 27% from $7 billion to $5 billion per year. This is an obvious case of killing the golden goose, given the fact that IBM functions in a fiercely competitive global high-tech industry populated by state-supported national champions who are more often interested in expansion than profits. In any event, had IBM's tax rate, share count, and R&D spending remained constant, its LTM profits would have been $7 per share, not $14.65. Compared to earnings of $5 a share in 2005, that amounts to a meager 3.5% growth rate. And that's the end of it. During the same 43-quarter period, IBM recorded $52.5 billion of depreciation and amortization charges on its capital stock. But in order to fund its giant financial engineering program, it pilfered billions from these accounts, plowing just $48 billion back into CapEx. Yet in the high-tech industry, companies ordinarily spend far more than their depreciation to stay competitive and accommodate growth of output. Actually, the big boys upstairs at IBM had another route to growth, and it involved a trick. Over the past decade, it's been a non-stop deal machine, announcing dozens of small and medium-sized acquisitions every year. They totaled more than $24 billion on a cumulative basis. But, like the man said, there was something deeply wrong with that picture. IBM's R&D spend at 5% of sales could have easily been boosted to 7 to 10%, like most of its large international competitors. Given its vast corporate research facilities and institutional knowledge base, there is virtually nothing that it could not have developed in-house with another $5 billion a year of R&D spend that it ended up acquiring through chronic M&A manoeuvres. But here's the thing. R&D hits earnings today, while M&A offers the corporate bigwigs a double goodie. Namely, IBM funded its deals with 100% debt at an after-tax cost of less than 1.75% and set up vast cookie jars full of purchase accounting reserves at the time of each deal. No wonder every acquisition was held to be instantly accretive by the sell-side analysts. The Fed handed over subsidized finance and the corporate accountants stumped up rising amounts of phantom income from the cookie jars in Armonk. And if deals failed, they were deleted from earnings as non-recurring expenses. Eventually, free lunches and financial engineering scams reach an unsustainable peak. And that is where IBM is today. IBM was once synonymous with the idea of a blue-chip credit. Back in 1987, in fact, its capital markets desk was adept at arbitraging the thin line of daylight between the US Treasury and IBM's AAA yield. No more. IBM's net debt was just $9 billion in 2005. Now it is $30 billion and rising. while the intellectual mountebanks at the Fed, especially Vice Chairman Fisher, puzzle about the stubborn decline in US productivity and potential growth. The truth lies in plain sight. Big Blue and much of corporate America is being destroyed by massive financial engineering, while insiders and speculators harvest obscene windfall gains from this fraudulent diversion of corporate cash. Needless to say, these self-destructive policies would never happen in the free market in a neutral tax regime. Real entrepreneurs and businessmen do not commit economic suicide. The truth is, the current so-called secular stagnation of the US economy is being manufactured in Washington. When the rest of corporate America succumbs to the resulting IBM swoon, perhaps the American people will finally pick up their pitchforks and torches. Well, I think the best explanation for why private markets are forcing interest rates to zero is that the banking system is broken. The system, which functioned for centuries on the basis of unsecured, reputation-based interbank lending, no longer exists. Zero interest rate policy, or ZIRP, is just evidence that the financial industry is turning to government as a source of the liquidity that the financial industry is no longer capable of creating on its own. You only have to recognize the refusal to deal with the derivatives problem head on. For some peculiar reason, economists and regulators have bought the idea that financial so-called innovation is always and ever good, and therefore should be given free rein. Even though the crisis would seem to have proven decisively otherwise, no one seems willing to question the value to anyone other than the banksters of the continuing growth of over-the-counter derivatives markets. And the ever-rising so-called need for more collateral is the direct result of the explosive growth of the derivatives market. Well, since the end of World War II, credit has been expanding in the US. First, it was a healthy expansion. Young middle-class families took out mortgages and ran up bills on charge cards such as Diners Club and American Express. Then, in the late 1950s, came the first credit cards. This was accompanied by large increases in consumer credit. Until the 1970s, all was well, because wages were rising, too. And with so much new technology coming online, people believed their wages could only increase. Debt was no problem, neither for the nation nor for households. We would grow our way out of it. But a strange and as yet not fully understood new trend began in the 1970s. After accounting for inflation, incomes for most Americans dramatically tapered off. The economy was slowing too, after taking the effects of inflation into account. At first, this was thought to be temporary, a fluke, perhaps caused by the 1973 oil crisis. But the trend towards lower economic growth continued. Decade after decade, the trend in GDP growth was down. In most parts of the US, GDP per person peaked in the 1970s or 1980s. Remarkably, the average American working man earns less today than he did a half century ago, again accounting for changes in consumer price inflation. That is not the same as saying that a person with a good job earns less today than he did in the 1960s. According to Census Bureau figures, the average inflation-adjusted wage for Americans in the top 5% of earners is up by more than 75% since 1967. Women earn a lot more too, but good jobs have become scarce. The labour participation rates, the number of people who have jobs or are looking for jobs as a percentage of the people who are of working age, is at its lowest level since 1977. But although economic growth and most people's incomes slipped, the debt, the flip side of credit, kept growing. This was stage two, the unhealthy phase of the credit expansion. No longer backed by broad-based wage increases, debt was expanding beyond the capacity of the economy and borrowers to repay it. Now we were asking for trouble. You may be wondering how this was possible. Why would lenders extend credit to people who couldn't pay back? The answer? The fix was in. In 1971, President Nixon dramatically transformed the global monetary system. Under the previous Bretton Woods system, the dollar was backed by gold, and the major global currencies traded at fixed rates to the dollar, and by extension, to gold. This meant a nation couldn't get too far into debt, especially when it came to its trading partners. Trade surplus nations, which amassed dollars in return for net exports to the US, could ask to redeem their dollars in gold. This caused gold to leave the overspending nation and flow to the creditor nation. That's how the US got so much gold in the first place. France and Britain spent more than they could afford on World War I. The US sold them food, weapons, and fuel, and demanded gold in repayment. But by the 1960s, the shoe was on the other foot. The US started spending money on both guns and butter, a great society at home and a war in Vietnam. Much of the spending to fund the war in Vietnam ended up as dollars in the hands of Vietnamese branches of French banks. And when, in 1965, President Charles de Gaulle sent the French Navy across the Atlantic to pick up $150 million worth of gold in exchange for dollars, it was greeted like a long-lost relative at the reading of the will. Finally, with gold being airlifted from Fort Knox to meet foreign demands for payments, rather than honour Washington's promises to convert dollars to gold, Nixon panicked and defaulted. Henceforth, anyone holding dollars was on his own. Well, ladies and gentlemen, before I leave you, let me just give you a quick update on my email problem. It has partially been resolved. And when I say partially, I mean probably for another 2 weeks we're going to be out of the woods, but then we're going to be in trouble again. And I'm working as fast as I can to try to patch up the end of the two-week period with the beginning of, hopefully, the new permanent good period, but I'm not sure if I'm going to make it. But so far, we're okay. It's a little bit fragile, as I say, but you should be getting your emails and they should come to you without trouble. So hopefully all is well. And this is me, Richard Martin, at the Wake Up Call, saying have a great weekend. I'll be back with you on Monday. Until then, bye bye for now.
And there you have it. You decide.